Richard Sterling has said he will eat anything once. That claim has taken Sterling around the world in search of gustatory challenges as well as a good meal. For him, eating is an adventure, a way of exploring different cultures through their use of grains and vegetables, fish, meat, spices, sauce, and food rituals. Sterling grew up eating that all-American diet of meat and potatoes. When he was stationed off the coast of Southeast Asia while in the Navy, he experienced a different kind of cuisine, one that opened his taste buds and whetted his appetite for travel. He has since written several books, Dining with Headhunters, A Guide to San Francisco Restaurants, and he's just edited a collection of essays for the Traveler's Tales series called Food, True Stories of Life on the Road. When I spoke with Richard Sterling, I asked him if travel has a way of stimulating normally dormant taste buds.
It's a way of consuming the culture. You know, I've always felt that humanity is revealed through cuisine. Just as surely as it is through any other art or social activity, in the customs and traditions involved with the growing preparation and sharing of food, we can see people, we can see cultures revealed easier than many other art forms. You know, you don't have to speak the language to eat the food, and Oftentimes, sculpture or painting require some kind of explication. But anybody with a willing palate and a passionate curiosity can discover another culture at the table.
So maybe you can learn as much about a culture from eating their food as you can by looking at their art?
Exactly. Well, not just the plain consuming of calories, but the way in which people break bread together, the way that they grow their food, the way that it's presented on the table. You know, if you just get yourself invited home to dinner, it's better than going to museums.
I bet. You've said you'll eat anything once. Have you ever truly regretted saying and doing that?
Have I truly regretted that?
Truly regretted. Because as you've dedicated your life to adventurous eating.
Yeah, well, I didn't really like a sea cucumber once in Korea. It kind of grossed me out.
How come?
But otherwise, well, it didn't taste like anything, and it had a slimy, nasty texture that... I didn't even have to swallow it. It seemed to, like, take a life of its own, and it slithered down my throat. So that's one thing I've eaten only once. Most things I'll eat again. One of the most memorable examples of what I've eaten again, but not with quite as much gusto,
right,
is a bowl of blood.
Yes,
I didn't know it was a bowl of blood. It was cooked, and this was in the Philippines. Tasted like some really very delicious beef stew cooked with red wine. And I ate it with gusto, and then I found out that it was cooked pig's blood. And that's all that was in it. It was just cooked blood.
But you said there were little chunks and things in this.
Oh, yeah. I thought there were dumplings or something, little flavor buds that it turned out that the cook had prepared. It had cooked it a little bit too fast, and much of the blood had clotted. And these clots were the most delicious part. They were kind of like peanut butter. And I'd press them against the roof of my mouth, and it would release this wonderful, rich flavor. I just ate a bunch of that stuff. And then I found out what it was. And I've eaten it since, but it has never tasted quite as good.
But isn't that interesting about how, if you don't know what something is, how you can have a totally sensual, tasty experience with a food, but the moment you know what it is, it changes everything.
Yes, it does. If it's something like blood, but then again, it can enhance it when you find out that what you're eating is passion flower,
which tastes like.
It's a unique taste. Kind of like jasmine flower. How's that?
Doesn't help at all. Sweet.
It's a great salad.
Sweet though? Is it sweet tasting?
No. It's fruity, and it kind of fools you into thinking that it's sweet because of its fruity aroma. Sort of like a dry wine could sometimes taste a bit sweet if it's got a very, very flowery nose.
My guest is Richard Sterling, and we're talking about food and travel, something that he does a lot of. Tell us about some of the adventures that you've had, and you've written about eating fish that was salted with ants.
That was a trip to Borneo several years ago. It was before the interior was even fully mapped. It was in 1976, actually. My friend Mac and I were young and full of ourselves and had some time and some money to spend, so we thought we'd go and see the wild man of Borneo, and maybe we'd find the wild woman, too. Who knows? So we traveled up the Rajang River, past all of the known settlements. We had with us a local interpreter named David. We got somewhere way deep in the interior to where we came to a longhouse village. And we were feted by the chief of the village and some of the women who prepared for us this fish, a river fish. And I watched them prepare it because even at that time I was very interested in cookery. So I watched them prepare it because I wanted to be able to go home and prepare the same thing myself, so that I could have this, you know, I could relive the feast. Well, one of the women reached into a section of bamboo. That's one of their common containers for liquids and small articles. She reached in there and she pulled out something that I took to be some sort of a spice. And she crumbled it up in her hand and she sprinkled it on the fish. And what she had just sprinkled the fish with were red warrior ants. Mm. So then they were presented to us with due ceremony, and everybody was looking on to us, waiting for us to have that first bite of what they knew was going to be something real tasty, a special dish, great treat just for the foreign visitors. Now, I say I'll eat anything once, but that's what I say now. I didn't say that in those days. I was rather taken aback by the idea that I was going to eat ants, even though their bodies were a bit broken apart. They were still distinguishable. I could still, these are big ants, and I could still see the claws and their jaws. And Mac and I looked at each other and said, "Well, you know, maybe we could pretend they're paprika, or maybe we could just brush them off." We noticed that the people were getting impatient, waiting for us to taste this. So I said, "Well, gotta do what you gotta do." I broke off a chunk, stuck it in my mouth, and I bit down, and the heads and jaws crunched audibly between my teeth. But at the same time, I got a burst of flavor that tasted like a mixture of lemon and tarragon, which are the main seasoning ingredients in béarnaise sauce. It was like crunchy béarnaise. So I thought, this is not too bad after all. I never did quite get used to the crunch, but I figured, you know, if you ground these up in a mortar and pestle, use them like pesto, it might not be too bad.
So have you ever tried to recreate this recipe for your friends or family over for dinner?
Yes, I have.
Well,
I didn't use ants, actually. You got to have just the right kind of ants. You got to use big red warrior ants because they have formic acid coating their bodies, and that's where that flavor comes from. Black ants that we see in our homes here have a bitter taste. But I was able to approximate the taste of this recipe using lemon tarragon and some paprika, a bit of this, bit of that. And I put that in my first book, Dining with Headhunters.
Our guest is travel and food writer Richard Sterling. More about adventurous eating in just 1 minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to travel and food writer Richard Sterling. He's just edited a book of essays for the Traveler's Tale series called Food, True Stories of Life on the Road. What country do you think has the best food that you enjoy the best?
Whoa. Thailand and Italy.
Because?
Both are very flavorful. Both are very robust. Both can be both simple and complex. We do tend to think of Thai cookery as being, you know, heavy on chili and garlic. And it is. But Thai cooks are so skillful that they can make a dish roaringly hot and yet still full of subtle undercurrents and still never hide the flavor of the basic food. You know, for instance, if it's a shrimp soup, it can be positively incendiary and yet have subtleties and undercurrents just like a glass of fine wine, and you still never lose the taste of that shrimp. And Italian cooking is very similar. It doesn't tend to use very hot spices, but it does use a lot of seasoning, a lot of garlic, and wonderful olive oil. And they're both cultures in which people express themselves exuberantly in the kitchen and at the dining table.
You know,
they're places where eating is a joyous communal experience.
You've been talking about the sensuality of food, the sensuality of eating, the adventure of eating. And as you're talking, I'm thinking about a part of our own culture here that is totally food phobic. And it has to do with counting fat grams and counting calories and trying to figure out the latest way to come up with a chocolate cake that's not going to put any weight on you. How do you understand this culture, which, of course, you can eat around the world in the United States because we have every culture represented in this country? But that's on the one side. But on the other side, we have this sort of diet mentality that seems to really take away all the enjoyment of eating.
Yeah. You know, we just have what is, in many ways, an unhealthy attitude towards food. We don't think of it as creatively, as healthily, as even spiritually as we might. We think of it, well, you know, the traditional American diet is meat and potatoes. It's bland food that gives you a big full feeling in your stomach. And, you know, we inherited this from the English. I think it was their revenge for the American Revolution. but we tend to think of it either as fuel or as comfort or as something almost sinfully sensuous. We just don't think of it in the right ways. We don't think of it as something communal. We don't think of it as something that connects us to the natural world. When we consume and assimilate a chunk of the natural world, we reaffirm our own connection, our own reality, our own physical existence in the natural world. Other people do. Other people around the world do. Part of it, I think, is the fact that we live in an economy not of abundance but of superabundance. And that has always been the case, even before the Industrial Revolution. We know that because American soldiers in the Revolution were an average of 3 or 4 inches taller than British soldiers. We've always had plenty to eat. We've always had too much to eat. So, you know, we're one of the few peoples in the world who have to decide not what we shall eat, but what we shall not eat. I really think a big part of our problem is just that we have so much, and we have it so easily.
We don't know what to do with it.
Exactly. Yeah. People who spend, and this is most people, you know what? Most of the people in the world spend most of their waking or their working hours involved in some aspect of the growing or gathering or procuring of food. And then they spend a lot of their leisure hours in the sharing of it, in the taking of it together, and reaffirming their bonds with each other and with their community and with their earth, with their local geography, their history even. You know, there's a lot of history, culture, and tradition in food. But we do tend to lose sight of all of those wonderful things about it, and it just becomes this huge abundance that we abuse.
Well, Richard Sterling, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty. It's made me hungry.
Richard Sterling has just edited a collection of stories about adventurous eating for the Traveler's Tales series called Food: True Stories of Life on the Road.